This week on Decentralize, Roger Ver is denied entry into the U.S., then the Ross Ulbricht trial in New York, and the 2014 Decentralize Awards.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize. Welcome to Decentralize. Tony Sakic here with Eric Martindale, Chaz Ferguson, and James Walpole. How are you guys doing? You could hear the music in the background. And what's up?
What's up?
It's 2015.
It is 2015.
Oh, man, it's such a weird feeling. Like, just about a year ago, I imagined, I was in the on the brink of moving into the Bitcoin industry full time. And it's really hard to believe that it's been an entire year since then. It feels like almost overnight. And yet I look back and so much has happened in 2014.
I started in the Bitcoin industry in March, left my home state of Michigan and hometown of Detroit for greener pastures, and it's been amazing. I have to say, 2015 is going to kick ass. It's been interesting to see all the Bitcoin news lately, especially in the mainstream press where everyone's talking about how it's dying and dead, and I giggle because it's clearly not if you look at the metrics that really matter. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that are happening right now, per usual. And, you know, CES is happening right now, but I think we don't want to talk about that because it's kind of, you know, masturbatory. Look at these products. Look at these gadgets. Buy these gadgets. We have cooler stuff to talk about. Like, what was the best things that happened in 2014? Let's reflect a little bit, and then let's move forward. And, you know, I think we should all go around and maybe name something that we really dug in 2014. It can be anything, really. Just what did you enjoy?
So I was completely enthralled by the fact that the United States government was selling bitcoins to the public, and this blew my mind. Like, you know, 3 years ago, even 2 years ago, I would never have considered this like anomaly that the largest empire in human history, you know, the great state, the control of central control, like, would be selling an asset that is decentralized. It just is kind of mind-boggling to me.
I think it's Microsoft for me. It's Microsoft. It's the squarest computer company you can think of, and they're getting it. At least they're starting to. It seems like a lot of the decisions they're making, they made .NET open source, I believe. They're making other decisions that are really smart and actually modern. So I think Microsoft was the moment where it was like, wow, this is a really big deal. What Microsoft does still does matter. They may not have the coolness of an Apple or Google, but what they do have is an install base that outpaces the others by far.
Yeah, I'll follow on to that. Microsoft, it has really surprised me this past year. I did not anticipate in any capacity. They moved a lot of their code to GitHub from their own, you know, private, you know, sort of clone of GitHub. They open sourced .NET, like. Did anybody see that coming? Like, really? One of my first jobs was actually working in C# for the healthcare industry, and I was just like, this platform really is frustrating. And I could like watch from inside of the industry, you know, the rest of the software world sort of moving forward in leaps and bounds. And meanwhile, this closed source platform is just like grinding to a halt in its complexity and frustration, and developers suggesting better ideas and just completely not being listened to. So I was really pleased to see Microsoft's progress this year. And I think the new CEO has really moved the ball down the field with their decision to accept Bitcoin.
I think seeing the mainstreaming of the sharing economy this year has been most significant for me. The fact that this really tangible instance of decentralization of individual empowerment through technology is becoming so common, it's pretty inspiring. I mean, I used Uber for the first time this year, used ride-sharing services, looking forward to, you know, using home-sharing services like Airbnb, and seeing how this can be further decentralized. But really, the fact these things are being embraced, they're being used, they don't really require even a vast understanding of how the technology itself works. But they do tap into something which people already know, which is, you know, how can I, you know, provide value to my customers? How can I, you know, benefit from that as well? And how do I interact with, you know, with strangers now? I think the fact that this technology, sharing economy technology in general, does that so well, scales so well, and is so easily adoptable is a great lesson for future decentralized industries, decentralized technologies, to see how that model's really occurring rapidly and overcoming pretty much any objections just by the evidence of its value.
You know, though, with Uber, I think, you know, before this podcast in general fillets them too much verbally, what we need to do is remember that they're also taking advantage of the information given to them by citizens with things like God mode. That is a very real issue. And the fact that they were so open with it to show it off to people, it really is disturbing a little. It really is. And I mean, you know, I assume they have that ability to do that. I would always assume that. But I would also assume they would be responsible enough to know not to flaunt it. And they didn't. You know, they flaunted it. And that's an issue to me. It's an issue, you know, privacy is an issue, and it's coming up. And I think with what we said with Microsoft, I want to hit one more thing on what I think they're going to do in 2015 that I think is important. And they're talking about Windows 10 being a free upgrade for everyone that has XP and Vista and all the legacy Microsoft operating systems. That's important. It gets rid of a lot of old code that's clogging it up, making it very unusable. I can't wait to see Windows refresh itself and just, you know, start over again. It's really needed a lot. I want to talk a little bit about the Ross Ulbricht trial. It just is something where we had a fascinating discussion off air about jury nullification, about exactly what's happening. And Eric, I wanted you to introduce a little bit of the information that you introduced to us.
Okay, right. So jury nullification. All right, the Ross Ulbricht trial, allegedly DPR of Silk Road 2 fame. He's on trial in New York. They've sort of shuffled around the dates because they were aware of attempts to sort of protest against it, and they didn't want to like start a scene. It's of course there in New York City, so it's been a big a sloppy mess on account of the state. So there's a concept in law called jury nullification, and jury nullification is when the jurors in a court case feel that the law that the defendant is accused of violating is just simply irrational or unjust or whatever it may be. If they believe and they conclude that the law is such, and they are informed or supposed to not be informed of their ability to do this, but if they just simply from nothing decide that the law is unjust, which is what makes it a prickly subject, then they can just simply decide that the law is unjust and nullify the case, nullify the jury, right? The jury nullifies the law. So it's really tough because for all due justice, if you were to believe in this centralized court system, and I believe in a decentralized court system where maybe this is valid in one, not valid in another, and you get to choose which law system you want to follow. If under the current justice system, if a jury is aware of jury nullification ahead of time, then they may enter the case with sort of a bias towards the testimony that they hear. However, if they were to objectively, the idea is that they would objectively look at the law and the defendant and say that this is just a completely an unjust law that they under no sane and rational mind could conclude that despite the fat person may or may not have violated the law, that the law is just stupid, so they throw it out. So the state's current argument against jury nullification is that you cannot provide a fair jury if they're aware of the fact that the jury is just simply able to throw the law out. Now, there are ongoing protests in New York. A lot of core supporters of decentralization and the freedom movement and the liberty movement are there in New York actively spreading information about jury nullification. Now, this is a curious subject because in doing so, I believe that they may or may not actually be committing a crime. Certainly, it's questionable if it's illegal for a juror to be made aware of prior or serve on a juror having knowledge of this beforehand. Now, mind you, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm only, you know, telling you what I think I know.
You'd be a great lawyer. Yeah. Perfect.
thanks, I appreciate that. Sort of. no, it's just really interesting. Like, I if he's the alleged DPR, just the same. I mean, the judge is saying that, you know, you're not allowed to bring your, you know, political views into this courtroom, right? You're on trial for X, Y, and Z. And frankly, like, this case is gonna, I hope, go all the way to the Supreme Court and point out the ridiculous injustices that our current legal frameworks have set. We've gotten, you know, 200 years plus of ridiculous jurisprudence, creating this massively confounded system of contract and law and, you know, all these, this bullshit, man. Like, I really hope that this shines a spotlight on the grime that's caught up in grime and cobwebs that are caught up in the corners of centralized legal systems. So I'm really excited for this Ross Ulbricht trial to move forward, and I really hope that it falls on the side of liberty and freedom rather than over state control and absurdism.
I think that no matter what side, though, you're on, I don't think that it's going to come to that, because I think that the system of justice is so fundamentally broken that, okay, we're going to have – the jurors are going to be screened first and foremost. If I was ever on a jury, I don't know what I would say. I don't know if I'd want to get out of it or if I'd want to participate, whatever. But, you know, there's the old joke about, hey, I'm going to go to the jury and tell them I'm racist just so I can get out of jury duty. So we have jurors that don't want to be there. They're paid next to nothing. They're missing work. And then they're going to basically be essentially the judge, not really, you know, physically, but they're going to be judging someone and giving them freedom or not, based on whether they think they did something or not. And there are all these rules of what's allowed and what's not, and the rules are never in favor of the accused, ever. They're always in favor of the prosecution, and I think that's what's broken. And when we look at how many people are in prison, and for dumb reasons that most people agree they shouldn't be in prison for, and people think, oh, you know, the government should do something about this, that's another thing. Whenever that's said, that's where the problem is that you're adding another law, you're adding another layer. We need way less laws. We need a few common sense laws, and that's it. And then it needs to stop. It needs to be like, don't rape, don't murder, don't steal, don't assault. You know, maybe a couple more that I can't think of right now, but that's it.
You know, it's funny. What you're describing was written in stone a long time ago, and that was the base law.
I think in principle, all of our current laws should be forced to be written in stone.
I don't think
by chisel, by an old judge. Because then, in order for something to be a law, it would have to really matter. And he should be feeble, he should be 90,
yeah.
He should be barely able to hold the chisel. Like,
yeah, the question, you're creating back pressure against, you know, creating more laws, I totally agree with. But I think it should be based – the thing I mean to point out there is not sort of, you know, this Christo-Judaism sort of perspective, but rather that it really should be a social contract between agreeable peers, not a forcibly, you know, authoritarian perspective on law, right? Like, this shouldn't be the state issuing the law on high. This should be the people agreeing to a mutual contract between one another. Not, you know, some authority figure telling you this is the way that it is and there's nothing you can do about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, so many times, often the social contract is argued as a contract made on the basis of birth in a geographic location. So I think brings us to another interesting story this week. Roger Ver actually was denied a visa to re-enter the United States after having renounced his U.S. citizenship. So you're seeing there, you know, a very interesting playing out of the legal system is based on this, you know, enlightened idea of the social contract of implied consent to a governing system. So I do think this is very interesting. This is the Bitcoin Jesus, renounced his citizenship. I'm lost, actually.
That's funny, because you said Bitcoin Jesus. That's what lost me, but every time I hear that, though, I giggle. I think that the whole idea that your geographical location does have anything to do with citizenship, like, it's what? Like, I don't consider myself an American. I consider myself a human, because that's, like, I don't know what I am. And I try not to think about it more than that. Like, I happen to be in the United States because that's where I'm at, but it's just a latitude and longitude that I'm at for the second. It could change, and it will change. It's really another thing that internet is tearing down, and it's tearing it down slowly, but it's tearing down a lot of geographical borders. You're seeing it with companies that have offices in different countries that, you know, just exist completely, you know, in a collaborative effort toward one goal. And that's something that's still rather new on a scale with the internet. So it's changing, and as broadband speeds increase, it's going to only increase. And I don't necessarily think anytime soon we're going to see the end of, you know, geographic nations existing. But what we are going to see is a different mindset toward people and the nation that they're a part of or they're born in.
Yeah, so the idea of a nation state only exists due to historical reasons. Roger Ver being, you know, his, you know, entry into the United States being rejected is a legal formality that is merely a figment of our contemporary times. This nation state thing that we're wrestling with as a society now, increasingly so, it only exists because prior to sort of global communication, most recently with the internet and its accessibility through mobile devices, and prior to that radio and television, and prior to that the printing press, it only existed because it was simply not feasible, not optimal for individuals to come to an agreement about self-governance without sending someone a long way to sit down and talk with their peers. So we ended up with, you know, this system that is intended to establish rule and authority for the great goodness of the people, because the people simply did not yet have the means truly to organize amongst themselves. The world changed permanently when we established speed of light communication around the world. And it's up to everyone across all of humanity, whether you're an American citizen, a European Union citizen, a member of North Korea or Russia or Malaysia, it's up to everybody to sort of help spread access to this new global communication infrastructure, because that is the only way free and open communication that we're ever going to be able to free ourselves from the tyranny of the state. So this Roger Ver thing is, again, just a figment of this, like, you know, temporary period that we're in. This is like, it frustrates me, but it just points out the inconsistencies of the whole thing. Like the fact that, you know, just because of where we're born and some sort of arbitrary lines drawn in the sand that were, you know, from an era, you know, in our case, a couple hundred years old, in, you know, many other countries, thousands of years old, lines that were drawn in the sand, blood was spilt over them, people were killed to defend those lines, right? It's just, how could we ever claim to be a civilized society when we're fighting over an imaginary line in the dirt? This is just silly to me.
Well, it is silly, but I'm going to provide an alternate viewpoint on this, and it may be controversial on this podcast, and it's with Roger Ver. He did renounce his United States citizenship. That was a decision he made, right? And as much as I disagree with the way that, you know, that works, that the geographic location works, he also has to understand what game he's playing and whose game he's playing right now. He's not playing humanity's game. He's playing the government's game, because they have power. And they do. It's a fact. F-A-C-T. There's nothing around that. They have the power to say, hey, you can't come here if you want to renounce your citizenship. So I do feel bad for him in one aspect, but in another aspect, I want to say, well, maybe you shouldn't have renounced your citizenship. You know, there is a difference between standing up for what's right and making a decision that's going to screw you over in the future from spreading other really important information to others. And you need to sometimes suck it up for the team and take it so you can actually help things be better in the long run. That's definitely something I feel is what makes me very alone in this podcast, because I don't know if anyone agrees with me here, but I'm a big proponent of fit in, don't cause too much of a ruckus, see good ideas, promote good ideas, see technology, promote good technology, and let people make up their own minds. And, you know, then live your life as happy as you can and as free as you can. And that's what I try to do. And I mean, there are different perspectives on this. And I think ideologically, most people that are a part of this decentralized movement agree. But I think on the tactics is where we disagree. And that's something right there where I feel bad for him. But in the same token, I'm like, well, maybe you shouldn't have said that.
I think Roger Ver has something very important that the majority of the world at this particular juncture is severely lacking in, and that is courage.
Yes.
Roger Ver had the courage to stand up and refuse to be associated with the crooks and criminals that is the United States government, right? The people who are there, who are
accepting... So did Malcolm X.
Okay, I stand for Roger Ver's bravery in saying, you know what? I refuse to be associated with that criminal system. The only way to win this game is to not fucking play. Don't fucking play the state's
game. The war game's defense.
I think that Roger Ver, by leaving the United States, said, I don't subscribe to your statist, centralized, like... You know, stand for the good of the people. We must all suffer together. No, he's making a stand and saying your system is completely fraudulent. I'm out.
Then why does he want to come back?
He wants to come back for the Miami Bitcoin Conference, which happens to be in Miami. Now, he's pointing out that despite the fact that, you know, he's not getting the money that he paid into the government back, you know, you saw the tweet about it, you know, he paid, you know, X amount in Social Security in taxes and all of this. Mm-hmm. And he showed a screenshot of, you know, what the government owes him. Like, why doesn't he get that back? He's not a member of the United States anymore. He left. Why shouldn't he have the freedom to choose what he wants to associate with? And the government should pay back its debts to him because he paid into it. I think he shows courage, and we could all show a little more of it ourselves.
And I think the ultimate value here that I think both you and Eric are emphasizing in different ways is sort of the free association that we all want. We all want to be able to travel where we want. We all want to be able to work with the people we care about. We all want to use the technologies we enjoy, and we want to live our lives in peace. And there are obviously obstacles to that. There are obviously disagreements on how that's best achieved. But it's really important to recognize, you know, what we're trying to work toward. Recognize that, you know, we should really have these important freedoms of travel, important freedoms of. Of movement that are so important to spreading these ideas and spreading, you know, building the relationships that are going to be building these ideas.
And that's why the most important things happening right now are the security movement and technology, because that is what is giving the freedom of movement. It's the freedom of movement of information and the freedom of someone else not to know your information, the freedom of you to have that and for someone that you, the dedicated receiver to have that. And that's really something that's you're starting to see that Snowden effect come in, where you're seeing, you know, people noticing and caring way more. You're seeing a lot of the things leak that did leak, and it's going to be good. To me, Snowden is 10 times the hero that Ver is, honestly, because he gave us information. Before, I assumed the NSA was always spying on me. I did. I assumed. Didn't know. Now we know. And it is good to know, and it's good to know to the degree, and it's good to know how, and it's good to know why, and it's good to know what they think. Know your enemy. Know who your enemies are. My enemy is not the government at all. My enemy is people that are trying to take away the freedom of privacy. And it just so happens there are government agencies that do that. And I'm not anti-government. What I am is anti-government agencies spying on innocent civilians. I think that's common sense.
Doesn't fit on bumper sticker, though.
That does not fit on a bumper sticker, but you know, sometimes what you have to do is just, you know, embrace what you can control, and, you know, embrace what you can't control, and try to be as happy as you can in your day-to-day life and work toward things that are change. I think there's a reason that we are all in this industry and doing this podcast, and that's because we give a shit. We give a shit to different degrees, we give a shit to different, you know, in different methods to do it, but we care, and that's more than a lot. And I can't wait to see more and more people wake up and say, okay, protesting in the street matters, but, you know, sometimes creating better technologies around it is what matters more.
Yeah, if you have the ability, contribute to the ecosystem. That's the best way to make change. And protesting in the streets is actually very important. And I, you know, for example, you know, with this Ross Ulbricht trial, I really, really support what they're doing. But if you have the ability, the best thing to do is put your money where your mouth is. go out and get a job in the decentralized ecosystem and build something that contributes.
Or
right?
I'm marketing. I'm not a guy that's a developer, but I contribute. I contribute my skills.
Create. It doesn't have to be code.
Exactly.
Create. Build.
Code matters a contribute. Lot. Don't get me wrong.
Contribute.
But, yes.
It's like when the state collapses, the infrastructure, it's going to be really painful. Okay, because people just are this massive vacuum of authority. People aren't going to know what to do with their own freedom because they've been nannied into the state that they are today. So the amount of work that we put in today to build this infrastructure is crucial to minimizing the pain for when the state actually collapses.
I disagree with you completely. I think that if the state collapses, I don't think it's an inevitability, nor do I necessarily think it's complete positive. What I do think, though, is it's going to happen completely. It's going to be subtle. No one's really going to even notice. It's going to happen slowly. Things like Bitcoin are going to slowly take change will not happen overnight. There will be resistance, but it's probably going to be a psychological resistance rather than
we'll give you cryptographically secured tokens.
Ah, makes sense. And what we want to do is we want to go around and talk about cool things that happened last year. And I think the very most important thing is the best new decentralization startup. I think we should be very broad on this. You know, we don't want to be too specific. And I'm going to start. I'm going to say Changechip. It's been copied by other competitors already. And it's a cool way to, you know, send money to someone directly without any intermediary via social media. They're working on Facebook integration, Slack integration. It's going to be really interesting to see all the different platforms that you're going to be able to send someone Bitcoin to without really doing much effort at all. And that's my award-winning choice.
Yeah, I love Changechip, especially after they, I think they purchased the Reddit Bitcoin tip bot and
yes.
Turned that into basically Changechip. Nick Sullivan and his team does an absolutely fantastic job over there. But for me, I think the best decentralization startup in general is Storge. They got started in 2014. Sean Wilkinson, a pseudo Bitcoin core developer, if you will. He's contributed some work. He's been doing a lot of stuff in the Bitcoin space, in the crypto space. Launching Storge, and he's been a co-host on the show before as a guest host. And by the way, Sean, we really want you back. Yeah, so Storge is fantastic. This is, you know, shooting a huge chink in the armor for companies like Dropbox, who are overcharging for decentralized storage, not even decentralized, pseudo-decentralized storage up in the cloud, quote, which is nothing more than a rebranded, sort of reused hosting on someone else's server, which is dangerous all in its own right. So Storge is going to be huge. I have a lot of hopes for where they're going to come. They just launched their private sort of beta test with a series of invitees. And this is really going to change the way we think about storage in general. That's the name of their company, obviously. But it's no longer going to be just your local hard drive. It's going to be an encrypted file store that is completely ephemeral. You boot up a machine, it becomes a thin client, it connects to this grid. I love this idea, and I think it's going to be huge.
James?
For me, I think OpenBazaar really is one of the most exciting developments. Being a true, or providing a true opportunity for decentralization and trade, that's really the whole promise of a lot of these separate startups or developments like Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin being a medium of exchange, we don't need a platform on which to use it, where trade can be truly be free, as they say. They're very early in the very early stages of their development, obviously. But I think they have a lot of promise. I think they have a good team, and I think also they have a good brand for what they're trying to do. They have a good mission for what they're trying to do. And so I'm very interested in seeing how it develops over the next year.
Yeah, I think also a runner-up I'd like to name is FireChat. We've talked about it in the past on this show, and the more I use it, the more I like it. I think it's getting easier to use. There's more users. I believe they have around 10 million installs right now globally, which is amazing. That's really the number of installs is really what's going to be the main component of what makes it successful of any kind of decentralized chat app. And it was made for music festivals, you know, and I go to a lot of music festivals and getting service sucks. So a service like that is really awesome. And it really was designed for that, but it's taken over a life of its own. And people are seeing other governments, you know, crack down on local internet access. And since that happens, you know, here's this tool where you could just bypass all of that. You don't need it. It doesn't matter. They can cut the Wi-Fi. They can cut whatever. It doesn't matter. You're going to still be able to communicate. And it's really the basis of something new. It's giving people a new way to think. Because when people think Bitcoin, there's a lot of questions they have if they're completely unfamiliar with the technology. With FireChat, there's a lot less questions they ask because it doesn't require a financial commitment of any sort. You know, it's just downloading the app and seeing how it works. And it's going to grow, and I hope it becomes the de facto way that people chat.
I hope at some point in the near future, as near as possible, that the entrepreneurs and businesses that create actual device hardware bake into their device, or the carriers, the suppliers of service for those devices. Hopefully that will be decentralized, of course. I really hope that FireChat, Open Garden-like behavior is really just baked into the phone. Not because it solely because it's helpful to the population, protecting from censorship and unrighteous authority or authority in general.
Authority.
But rather because it would actually make better service. Like, think about it. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have to distribute these, you know, femto cells, you know, to increase coverage, which, by the way, are, you know, one of the sole sources of zero-day attacks on cellular networks. You can totally spoof a damn cell connection. And
how do those work? Break that down for me, because I've heard about this, and I want to know a little more.
So femto cells, most of the carriers initially wanted to increase the coverage. Mm-hmm. Now, what they failed to do beforehand is appropriately secure their networks. And this is a type of a hack that, you know, the NSA uses. The secret FISA courts will issue warrants, it or not, injunctions that will allow the NSA to basically spoof these connections and immediately listen in, unencrypted, on any communication that's using that femtocell, which is really scary because if you have, like, a sufficiently large arena, right, or a densely populated place like Times Square, or you know the location of an individual, you can simply follow along with them with a portable femtocell. Their phone conversations work as perfectly normal, just like a mobile phone, but using an attack on this network, the release of these keys allows for immediate and real-time decryption.
Now, am I also to be clear that this is one of the types of security faults that would even exist in something like the black phone using, you know, encryption? How would that work? Because I know that there was, I think it was, they called it a baseband attack from what I've read.
Okay.
And so is that similar?
It's a similar attack, the same surface, different vector. So the way that works is every device, even the black phone, mm-hmm. Has a chip on it that connects it to the base network. That base is able to receive a firmware update from the cellular network that it connects to,
okay.
Right? So that is completely decoupled from the device storage that your mobile operating system sits on top of, right? This is an underlying chip that provides it connectivity to the network and exposes itself as a modem device to your operating system. In many cases, it's Android. It may be, you know, even your iPhones do this stuff. And this is just a base firmware update or a patch that's like a bootloader, if you will.
That can be my Sidekick.
Yes, anything that connects to the cellular network,
yes,
would be vulnerable to this attack. And this includes the vast majority of sort of homegrown cell phones. So if you're one of the guys who's at home building your own cell phone, as many of us like to hope that we can build a project like that, you have to be extremely careful, and you have to take a deep look at the chips you're choosing to use, because unless you're actually completely in control of that software, and I, as far as the technical capabilities are concerned, I'm not even sure that it's possible to connect to the cellular network without allowing this baseband patch. So there's just a baked-in vulnerability to the entire cellular network.
That's it's ridiculous, and it's something that not a lot of people know. I mean, I knew a little bit about it, and now I know more, and our audience knows more. And with that being said, let's move on to something that's a little brighter, the Bitcoin Evangelist of the Year. And we kind of broke down a list, and I put Eric Martindale on there. I would say it's Eric Martindale and Shooter Jennings, who's become a friend of mine. And, you know, there's plenty more that have done higher profile things. But when it comes to the grassroots movement of introducing it to people, being excited about it, that's really what matters the most. I mean, the work that Andreas does in speaking to, you know, what was it, the Canadian Senate? Amazing. And what he does on his podcast is amazing. He's just a great ambassador for all things Bitcoin. He's the exact thing Bitcoin needs versus what it has had in the past. But then there are other folks that are using their notoriety or their notability just to spread the word. And I think that it's the grassroots efforts that are really going unheralded. And that's who I want to go. That's who I want to go with. And that's why I voted for you, Eric Martindale. And because you're doing it, and you're going one on one, and you're teaching people. And that's, you know, it's as old school as it gets, but that's how you teach people, and that's how people learn.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know it made you uncomfortable for me to add you to that list.
Yeah, so, I don't belong on this list at all.
I disagree, but continue.
I think people like Roger Ver, who are out there traveling the world, speaking at conferences, talking to business owners, like literally going out there, going to their supermarket, and like spending time out of their day to like slowly and carefully explain this complex, like world transforming technology and how it's going to impact their lives directly. Like, that is the most fundamental bare bones thing that you can do. And he's everywhere, man. He has a residence in Japan. He's been traveling around. He's been to Sydney. He's been to, you know, numbers of different locations, and is just literally in everything he does. He bleeds this idea of informing the people around him, in sharing this you know, vast wealth of knowledge and this technology and this sort of entire movement. So my vote goes to Roger Ver for all of his support throughout the years, but especially in 2014 for the entire decentralized movement.
I think with all of these, it's difficult to select one person. Because this is a decentralized movement. It's companies, individuals, everyone really doing the groundwork and making this technology work for people. For me, though, I will say for his contribution of a new perspective and a lot of personality, a lot of character to this sort of discussion, Jeffrey Tucker, actually, for really bringing, I think, a lot of economic insight, a lot of, again, personality. He's really embraced this and promoted this as a one of the tools we can all increase, you know, liberty in our lives and creativity in our lives. That this is not something we seek permission to innovate on, and really kind of broadening that perspective to a lot of different areas of life is a very important observation, I think. So I would say for this case, Jeffrey Tucker really infused a lot of life into this movement.
And with every great evangelist, there's also great failures. I don't think any of the failures that we're talking about or going to be talking about have anything to do with the evangelist, but it's going to be interesting. And it's the most epic fail of 2014. Gox, I don't think there's anything else that's close. I think some of you disagree. The Magic the Gathering online exchange was, for some reason, not a secure place to trade cryptocurrencies. Wonder why? Because maybe it's because, you know, your icy manipulator and your royal assassin weren't exactly worth Dogecoin. But yeah, I totally made a Magic reference because I played back in the day, and it was a sweet combo. But you know, it's not. Everything about that was fishy from day one, I thought. And the fact it was the de facto place to get your Bitcoin made it even a bigger failure. But what happened is, The shiesty individuals are getting weeded out, and people are learning, unless you control the private keys, you do not control the Bitcoin. Keeping them on a platform like that is dangerous. If you're going to keep $50 on there, fine. If you're going to keep a serious investment on there, you're crazy. And that goes for any exchange, any platform like that.
Any centralized exchange. And I'm really excited to see a number of growing, truly decentralized exchanges growing, like OpenBazaar. However, I'm ready to put a freaking nail in the coffin for this Mt. Gox thing. I am so glad that we have finally rung in the new year, and it has effectively been a complete year cycle since this whole Mt. Gox thing, you know, landed flat on its face. My vote also goes to Mt. Gox. Man, that was the single most consumer endangering, you know, disaster of an enterprise that could have ever existed. The fact that, you know, riding on the coattails of a world changing innovation, disruptive innovation, is an entrepreneur who absolutely fails to self-regulate, take appropriate precaution before coming to market. It's just completely irresponsible, and I am very glad that they are weeded out of the ecosystem. It wasn't the first, and it probably won't be the last, but I certainly hope that this one will be the worst. I think we will start to see the orders of magnitude of these types of kerfluffles to decrease. I mean, we're already off to an interesting start of 2015 with, you know, the Bitstamp hack, and you'll see that Bitstamp learned a ton from the whole Mt. Gox stuff, right? You can see that, you know, they've learned to segment everything that they've done, right? Their surface area for attack was tiny. And I think we'll continue to see this as we move towards decentralization. So I'm glad to have to be done with the Mt. Gox thing. It was, in fact, the most ridiculous, absurd thing that I think probably has happened in 2014. Epic fail, absolutely. But I'm glad that the repercussions of that are showing for the better in the Bitcoin ecosystem.
And speaking of riding on the coattails of innovation, Ben Lasky. and regulators in general. I don't know the man, but I do know how he's been treated and how he's treated this technology. I think it's been interesting and somewhat, it's bothered me for sure, seeing the lengths which movers in the Bitcoin industry and innovators have had to go to satisfy regulators or at least keep them away or even go to extra lengths to inform them. Merely due to the fact that they hold power over this really young industry, this really young technology. Certainly debate to be had, but the fact that, for instance, Ben Lasky was given a, you know, prime speaking spot at Money 2020 on the subject of Bitcoin, not necessarily due to, not due to any innovation he's provided in the ecosystem, but due to the fact that he has disproportionate power to affect it, That's really bothering to me, and it's entirely the opposite of the ethos that I think, you know, is really the great thing about Bitcoin. The fact that, you know, if you build something, you provide value to people, and they want it, then you'll be respected, then you'll have a position to talk about this. But when you have the power to take value away from people, that's bothering to me. So I think it's an epic fail. I think it's a tragedy, but it's also a comedy in a lot of ways, and I do think that we are seeing Ben Lasky draw back on his proposals for the BitLicense. I think this is hopefully a good sign. Seeing where regulation goes in the long term will be another issue entirely. But I think as long as decentralization is what people want, and I think it is what people want, or at least, you know, they'll soon know that they want it, there's hope. There are hopeful prospects.
Yeah, so the whole Ben Lasky thing makes me really sour. It's clearly a sort of a career play. He's doing his big regulation push poorly at that, solely so that he can get some cushy, you know, privatized job afterwards, right? Or some, you know, government appointment, right? He's going to go for SEC chair next. Woo-hoo. But honestly, I think the best course of action here is to just encourage the regulation to get stronger. Let's support it. Let's, you know, if regulation is so damn bad that the best thing to do to accelerate its demise is to just, like, let it get bigger until the people get so fucking pissed off that they say, you know what, this thing is, screw this, and we're throwing it out the window, right? The people will get angry, right? Let them see that, that this is absolutely the wrong way to do things. The Ben Lasky thing, man, just pisses me off so much. Like, I can't even share my thoughts on the air about that.
I think it's expected, but what I do think, and this is kind of a shared fail and win, is the changing media landscape when covering Bitcoin A lot of outlets are still very clueless. It's still out there, but it is better than it was a year or two ago. That's for sure. It's just a matter of how you view it. And is it an investment? Is it a currency? Is it a protocol? Obviously, you know, those that are in the know it's all, but it is something where all the articles at the end of the year saying Bitcoin is dead, I thought were comedic. It was just like, really? It's dead? Because it still has a value.
Did you see BitcoinObituaries.com or whatever it is?
I've heard of it.
It's so funny. It just sort of like catalogs the number of times that, you know, the journals or the press has, you know, pointed out that Bitcoin is dead again for the 49th time.
And it's a vampire.
If I'm on like a non-technology related subreddit and I bring up Bitcoin, man, I get laughed at and I get like, well, the best was someone went, Bitcoin, fucking LOL. And I saw that and I looked at it. I actually laughed. I was like, that's like an awesome response for many reasons, because one, they never bothered to delete it, so that's going to be archived. Two, it's just people hate what they don't understand again. And as soon as you understand it, there's so many people I've given the spiel to, and usually at the end of it, they're either obsessed or they think it's really cool and they have other things in their life to worry about, so they can't get obsessed with it. They understand that, you know, you don't control your money. No one controls their fiat currency. You just don't. And this is a more of a political backing than, you know, a technological discussion here. But they a lot of people don't care, but when they realize it, they start to care. And they think, okay, well, maybe this is a good idea. And you think about how many things this could make better. And, you know, what's coming out? And to segue into one thing I wanted to talk about, I know we have another award that we want to give, but of something I'm really excited for in 2015, and the more I read and the more I learn, is Ethereum. I can't wait. It seems to be the one that might actually matter. I don't ever think anything will be a Bitcoin replacement or Bitcoin 2.0. I hate that labeling, but I think it's going to have very interesting implications on property, on just law in general, and it's going to be fascinating to see it grow. I hope it launches in the time frame they're hoping. I don't know exactly the status of it from anyone in the company or anyone, you know, on the project rather. It's going to be awesome, though. I have very high hopes for it.
So let's move on. I think we definitely covered kind of who we think is what the biggest Bitcoin epic fail is. But because we're a family-friendly show, we should focus
on... No, we're not. What family are you talking about?
I try, Tony.
Like the Charles Manson family?
Anyway, I think let's focus in on the positive here and talk about who we've really enjoyed having on the show. Obviously, I'm kind of more of a recent addition, so we're going to be deferring more to Eric and Tony here. We've had a number of great guest hosts on the show who contributed their own kind of opinions and insights over the time of the show. I can certainly attest to enjoying having Andre on the show recently. But let's go around and hear what your thoughts on that.
Obviously, my vote goes to Sean Wilkinson of Storge. He's hilarious. He's young. He's technically savvy. He's informed. I think Sean, in a lot of ways, embodies the decentralized movement as a whole, in that he's educated, he's informed, and he's actually out there writing code to change things. Having his commentary was extremely helpful, and we really want you back. So. Come on back, buddy.
Yeah, for me, I'm going to expand it a little bit to go over a couple guests. I've grown a really good friendship with Shooter Jennings, so I'm listing him on there, and he was our first guest. I'm going to list Gordon Hall, who I thought was very entertaining, and I'm a big fan of Gordon, and I hope we get to have him back on here many more times. And finally, this is actually the only interview I conducted by myself, but it was with someone that I listened to for 14 years, and it's Brian Alvarez. And the reason I had him on was first and foremost, I'm a fan. Secondly, it's about information. And he was doing this podcast thing before podcasting was a term. There was a company called IATA in the late 90s, early 2000s. And they went belly up because, like a lot of the dot-com companies, they just completely wasted money on a Times Square studio. But what they did was they really started the internet audio thing. And his show was the show that really kept that entire station afloat for a year. I'm a big wrestling fan. That has nothing to do with this. What this does have to do with is information and how it travels. Internet audio existed before podcasting, and it exists now, and that's why we're here. And, you know, decentralization is just the biggest form of disruption that has existed. Podcasts definitely disrupted radio. That's why folks like Art Bell, you know, he's now has a bigger presence online than he has in on terrestrial radio, and he's been a terrestrial radio powerhouse for decades. Things are changing, and it's awesome. So that's going to be my vote for my favorite. It's really a personal choice more than, you know, dropping tons of knowledge on the audience.
I think that's a pretty good way to wrap up. We have a lot to look forward to in 2015. More guest hosts, more decentralization.
I want to thank everyone here and our great producer, Chaz, for manning the board. Have a great one, and can't wait for 2015.
Happy New Year.
Decentralize all the things.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yes.